is Ruiz versus United States. And Mr. Henderson, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Peter Henderson. I represent Jesus Ruiz. And I do think this, there are a number of issues here. I guess the first I'd like to focus on is the basis of the district court's opinion, which was harmless error, and then move to, I think, the most important question, which is what exactly was Mr. Ruiz convicted of? But let me start with the harmless error question. Harmless error is about really the bottom line. Does an error affect the judgment? And so if there's an erroneous jury instruction, but the judgment would have been the same, we call that a harmless error. In this case, the judgment has three counts of conviction, or at the very least one count of conviction, which the government agrees on, that is not a crime under federal law. That's as a result of the invalidation of the residual clause in United States versus Davis and Johnson. And so the judgment is wrong. There is no harmless error here. The judgment would have been different had the error been corrected. So the district court erred in that respect. And there are two aspects under Section 2255B when we have an error. If a sentence was unlawfully imposed, the district court shall vacate and set the judgment aside. So that's mandatory. The second part is discretionary. The question really is remedy. What does the district court then do? And it has a number of options. It shall discharge the prisoner or resentence him or grant a new trial or correct the sentence as may appear appropriate. And that's what the district court should have done here, is determine, use its reasoned discretion to determine what course to take. So, for example, we all agree that count nine, which charged the 924C conviction in relation to a conspiracy, is an unconstitutional conviction. That sentence, that the sentence on that count was 5 years, because that was the first 924C conviction. The sentences on the two other counts were 20 years because they were second 924C convictions. And so even if you agree with everything the government says on the merits, the district court should at the very least adjust the sentences on one of the other 924C convictions, because we're getting rid of the 5 year sentence. And so there's no first conviction left. And so the total of 45 years should be reduced to 25 years, not to 40 years. But all of that is to say that the district court has discretion to determine what the appropriate remedy is. And it went wrong here in just saying this is harmless error, because the judgment was affected. And that's what the harmless error test talks about.
Mr. Henderson, can I ask you to address the concurrent sentence doctrine? You know it well. It is doctrinally, just distinct by its terms, because we're not dealing with a concurrent sentence here. We're dealing with the consecutive sentences. But when I look at our court's opinion in the Ryan case from 2012, what I wonder about is how your position on harmless error here can be correct, and our panel decision in Ryan also be correct.
Well, so I think that there are two things involved. One is, what do we do with the conviction with a consecutive sentence? And I think that needs to be vacated, because what Ryan lays out, and especially in the earlier panel opinion before it went to the Supreme Court, is when you have a Section 924C charge that is, it's either you sustain it or you get rid of it. I think what Ryan is talking about really is the remedy, is that second part of 2255. And so if the district court were to decide this has no impact on my sentence, because it's all part of one sentencing package, I'm going to exercise my discretion to correct the sentence as may appear appropriate. And in this case, that means I vacate the conviction and I leave everything else the same. That's a different story, and that would be reviewed for abuse of discretion. And we'd hope to make our best arguments as to why the court shouldn't do that.
But wasn't Governor Ryan arguing with respect to his mail fraud convictions? And there were a half dozen of them or so. He was arguing about whether those convictions could stand. And as I read our panel opinion, all we did was say, well, it is important to make sure that two of them can stand because of the RICO predicate rule. But beyond that, we don't need to conduct a review of them because of the concurrent sentence doctrine. And the concern that I have, of course, you can see it if you just go a couple of steps ahead, is in a circumstance where Mr. Ruiz, faces a statutory mandatory life sentence, whether the reasoning of Ryan doesn't map over to make these errors harmless. Despite, I must say, the strength of your substantive presentation, Mr. Henderson, on the merits of this.
Right. And I think it does matter the difference between consecutive and concurrent. Part of the point of our argument is that Mr. Ruiz under Section 2255 has one shot to vacate these convictions. And what we don't want to happen is what happened to Stacey Haynes, where somehow you get rid of the mandatory life sentence. Maybe that comes 10 years down the line. But if you still got these 45 years on your sentence, then you're still suffering a consequence. And so in Governor Ryan's case, they were all concurrent sentences. He was going to serve no more time under any circumstance, so long as two of the convictions were appropriate. But in this case, we've got a real problem, given the limitations of federal habeas review, that if we don't vacate these convictions and correct the sentences now, there's on the next, change in the law, we're going to come in and the government's going to say, well, it's not prejudicial because he's still got 45 years more to go after this sentence. So I think the concerns that the Supreme Court laid out in Cibran are important about making sure we correct errors at the appropriate time instead of leaving it to another day. But I think that to answer your question directly, the main difference really is this is a consecutive sentence. And we have a lot less certainty about the prejudicial effect of these sentences in the future than we would have in Governor Ryan's case. On the merits itself, we have sort of a different harmless error question, because essentially the government argues that, well, Section 924C criminalizes just possessing a firearm in furtherance of the crime of violence. And we could have charged this case differently. And so the error is harmless. But the government is held to the crime of conviction that it charges and that it proves at trial through a jury verdict. That's guaranteed by the Due Process Clause. And we can't, using harmless error review, upgrade Mr. Ruiz's prior convictions under Section 924C into different convictions. That would amount basically to a directed verdict for the government. And so on count 10, Mr. Ruiz was convicted by a jury of Section 924C relating to simple kidnapping. That's how the jury was instructed. It's even clearer on count 11, because both the indictment charged and the jury was instructed to find Mr. Ruiz guilty on simple assault. It's a very similar thing to what we pointed out in our reply brief. If you charge one crime, and this is one crime because Section 924C requires that you incorporate the elements and charge the elements of the underlying crime. So where you charge one crime, you can't on appeal say, well, that crime is unconstitutional, but in fact, the facts show under harmless error review that he committed a more serious crime, and so we'll affirm that way.
So that Mr. Henderson, just on the kidnapping for a minute, count 10, looking back to count 7, the government's position is that, I don't have the indictment in front of me, but as I recall, the indictment does mention that a death resulted from the kidnapping. The jury instructions, I think you're right, do not instruct that's something the jury had to find. So I don't know whether you're getting into a Mathis kind of discussion about what's an element and what's just a, some lesser thing which tells us that it wasn't the death results part of the kidnapping statute. But how do you answer the government's argument that when you look at both the indictment and what the proof showed, you can see the more serious crime is there?
Right. So Mathis requires that we determine what crime the jury convicted Mr. Ruiz of. And it, so count 10 is a tougher question than count 11 because of that language in the indictment. But it's well established that the government gets to pick how it goes to trial and what it proves at trial. And it can always prove a subset of allegations. You know, you don't have to allege everything in an indictment. And there are sometimes allegations that aren't elements. And so the real question under Mathis, and I think under Haynes, you'll see we look both to the indictment and to the jury instructions, because the government is always permitted to proceed on a subset of the allegations in the indictment, so long as, you know, you can prove less. You can't prove more, but you can prove less. Right. So I think that that's why the jury instructions are important here. But I agree with you that it's a closer call than on count 11. Just given that count 11 charged only a simple assault, there's no allegation of aggravated assault.
With regard to the assault on the federal officer, didn't that charge a violence in the instruction?
No. So the district court directed the jury to find that it was a crime of violence. But apart from that, it just gave the elements of simple assault under Section 111A. Which the courts of appeals have almost universally said is not categorically a crime of violence. So we don't look to the facts, you know, whether this particular case involved violence or not is really irrelevant.
Judge King, can I ask Mr. Henderson one more question just to get the benefit of your. So what I struggle with in this case is these questions about what qualify as a crime of violence or not, especially when we start down the path of the modified categorical approach, and you start, well, should we go with the jury instructions or should we look at what the ultimate sentence was? You know, this gets really, really hard, and we're in areas of law that continue to develop all around us. The answers just aren't clear, and these are tough questions. So what I wonder about, Mr. Henderson, is your view on whether and how that should inform our harmless error analysis in terms of avoidance. Because I hear you on the prospect that the law can change. But on this fact pattern, unfortunately, you know, your client faces a situation where it would have to change in probably multiple ways to result in seven life sentences, right, being vacated. And so that's where I start to wonder, this seems like that is such a long shot that maybe that should, and we would otherwise prefer, you know, to avoid answering hard questions before we have to. I'd just like to get the benefit of your reaction to that.
Right. I understand that concern. I guess the first thing that comes to mind is that the law has changed. Every single one of his sentences is unconstitutional at this point. Now, some of them, the change is not retroactive as applied on collateral review. All it would take is Congress saying, you know, our prisons are too full, Booker applies retroactively, go back to court. And that's it. So I don't think that there's a number of obstacles, because the law has changed and all of the sentences are already unconstitutional. And I think, frankly, that's a good reason for the district court to exercise the discretion and authority it has under Section 2255 to say, let's hold a resentencing. And it may be that I find that a life sentence is appropriate, but at least this sentence is going to be in accordance with the Constitution, rather than defer. Because again, the procedural hiccups that you know well with 2255, 2241, it just makes sense to resolve these sorts of claims right now. And if the most that Mr. Ruiz gets out of this is one conviction's gone, 20 years are off your sentence, and you're still stuck, that's at least a step forward in the process, so that we're not continually relitigating the same issues under a sort of deference to, you know, not deciding things that maybe don't have a practical impact now. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Ms. Kastick.
Yes, good afternoon, and may it please the court. Andriana Kostanek on behalf of the United States. The district court properly denied habeas relief to the defendant. He received 7 life sentences, 2 of which were mandatory. The district court had no discretion but to sentence him to life imprisonment. And if this case were remanded to the district court for resentencing, the same sentence would result as a result of those mandatory life sentences.
But it wouldn't be the same sentence, Ms. Kostanek. It would potentially be a sentence that didn't have a consecutive 45 years. And I have to say, there are 2 perspectives that make me think that is significant, one of which Mr. Henderson has alluded to. We're in a time of very interesting criminal justice reform. We've seen the Fair Sentencing Act. We've seen the First Step Act. We've seen a serious discussion in the country about the length of sentences. I don't have a crystal ball, but it seems to me conceivable on a bipartisan basis that Congress might do something, at which point that 45 consecutive years becomes important. Mr. Henderson also points out in his brief a number of collateral consequences of those particular 3 convictions, counts 9, 10, and 11, on Mr. Ruiz's situation in prison, somebody with a 924, several 924C convictions. So I am quite disinclined to say, what's another 45 years among friends if you already have 7 life sentences? Why have more than 1 life sentence? Why didn't they just forget it on the others? And we don't do that. We sentence on each count of conviction. And that's without even getting into the fact that were this case to come up today, many of those sentencing decisions would be made under a significantly different framework.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may address that in 2 parts, I'll start with the issue of there could be changes in the law that affect the legitimacy of this life sentence. As Judge Scudder noted in response to one of Mr. Henderson's points, that may be true in a case where you're talking about 1 life sentence. This is 7 life sentences, 2 of which are mandatory. And the idea that the court should entertain a challenge to those consecutive 45-year sentences when it would be quite far-fetched to imagine that all of those sentences go down the drain is, in the government's position, is not consistent with this court's case law. It's particularly not consistent with the concurrent sentence doctrine. And the
but
government, of course,
concurrent did not sentences. That's the thing with concurrent sentences, as we had in Ryan. They're concurrent. And so you could have 75 of them and it would be the same, or you could have 2 of them, or you could have anywhere in between. These are, whatever else they may be, they're not concurrent sentences. So you're asking for a new doctrine for us to make up by analogy to the concurrent sentence doctrine, and with what warrant?
Yes, and we certainly recognize they're not concurrent sentences, and that's not why the government cited the doctrine in its brief. It's because it's analogous. And ordinarily, consecutive sentences do matter. If you have a 20-year sentence on a drug count, and then 924C counts that are consecutive, of course there is going to be harmful error. Here, when you have 7 life sentences, those consecutive sentences, the nature of them, get subsumed within the life sentences. And
well,
so, in fact,
the life sentences are consecutive. The life sentences are concurrent, one assumes.
Right.
The only consecutive sentences are the 924C sentences. And it makes a difference if you're convicted on 8 counts or if you're convicted on 11 counts. It affects your criminal record. And I just, the doctrine of as long as there's 1 life sentence, then it's automatically harmless error for whatever other sentencing or conviction errors are there is not one that I find supported in the statute.
OK, Okay, so what I meant about saying that they're subsumed within the life sentence is not that those life sentences themselves are consecutive. The point is the defendant will spend the rest of his life in prison.
Probably so, as long as the United States stick with this longer is better criminal sentencing philosophy. But if we should move to a different philosophy and Congress chooses to make it retroactive, as they've done with some recent reforms, we would be in a different position.
Yes, Your Honor, theoretically, except for the defendant has mandatory life sentences under 1203.
I understand, I know. He's, and he could have had the death penalty for the same thing. I understand that. But he, in fact, got the sentences that he did, and I was talking about legislative change, and so the last I checked, Congress is the authority when it comes to legislative change. There's nothing fixed about this, and so what the statute says, 2255 doesn't have a separate set of rules for multi-count convictions. It goes conviction by conviction. He could have also had a conviction for drug dealing or something like that, given the nature of his collection business. And that would have been separate. And we don't deny relief just because somebody has a few life sentences. I don't know of any case that said that.
I don't read the case law in the same way, Your Honor. I think habeas relief requires that the defendant prove prejudice. And that's true whether you look at this as a procedural default or whether you look at it under a harmless error standard. The court is not entitled to correct the same errors on habeas review as it is on direct review. And so the defendant must establish prejudice.
He's not I read doing the panel- that, but you know, 2255, which I'm looking at, doesn't say that. What it says is if the sentence was imposed in violation of the Constitution or laws, etc. It doesn't say unless the court thinks it doesn't matter. If it's an illegal conviction, which thanks to Johnson 2015 and Davis, this is, it's an illegal conviction.
And I don't think that that can be reconciled with the court's opinion in Ryan, which specifically declined to address each of those mail fraud
convictions.
Because
they were concurrent.
Yes, Your Honor. But I don't think that it's necessarily because they were concurrent. It was because...
Why do you say that?
Because the court specifically stated in that opinion that if it were to find that one or two or three of those convictions was invalid, it would have no impact at the end of the day on the amount of time that the defendant served.
And that's an absolutely correct statement for a concurrent sentence.
Yes. And the government
wouldn't matter if things changed, if the whole world could turn inside out, and that would still be true. Whereas that's not true with a consecutive sentence.
Yes. And the government's position is that it is for all the reasons we've talked about. Because of these mandatory life sentences, the number of life sentences, the fact that he will never reach the time in which he will serve those 45 years, all of that, in the government's view, makes this more similar to that concurrent sentence doctrine.
Then why are you fighting so hard to keep count 10 and count 11? By your own account, this is meaningless. And the government is fighting tooth and nail to keep counts 10 and 11. What is it that you're getting out of this?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the government's interest is in making sure that habeas relief is confined appropriately, as it is by this court's prior case law, to those limited and extraordinary circumstances in which collateral review is appropriate. So the court does not have any discretion. There's no authority to grant relief to this defendant under the habeas provisions where he cannot establish an impact ultimately on the time that he served. Your Honor also made mention to the some collateral consequences as a result of those 924C convictions, and the defense in his reply brief identifies things like, you know, he could be impeached in a future proceeding if he testifies. He could, for example, be convicted of a 924C offense if he got his hands on a gun in prison and then committed a crime in connection, you know, possessed or used that gun in connection with a crime of violence. In addition to being kind of far-fetched, the case law reflects that those are not collateral consequences that are considered to be within the realm of custody for purposes of the habeas statutes. And for that reason, the government's position is that those would not be collateral consequences like the special assessment, for the same reasons as that special assessment, that could remedy the harmlessness here.
But please, Ms. Kostanek, you're not saying he doesn't satisfy the in custody requirement with 7 consecutive life sentences. You can bring up other things as long as you are in custody, and he most certainly is.
But the question is whether those collateral consequences, which also cannot form the basis of habeas relief, can mean that the court addresses convictions in the absence of harmless, or with where there's a harmlessness issue. And what Ryan, that opinion says about special assessments, holds true of these other collateral consequences as well, which are not the proper scope of the habeas petition. Regarding the kidnapping predicate, if I can turn briefly to the merits, the defendant was convicted of aggravated kidnapping. This is very clear from the J&C as well as the oral imposition of sentence. The district court specifically sentenced him to mandatory life in prison on that count, which necessitated a finding, granted pre-Apprendi and pre-Elaine, but it necessitated a finding that the defendant was in fact guilty of the enhanced version of kidnapping. If this court were to address, I mean, I agree with Judge Scudder that these are difficult issues of how you determine for a pre-Apprendi, pre-Elaine case.
Ms. Kostanek, I'll give you another minute to go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor, of how to address what that underlying crime is. But we know that harmlessness applies to Apprendi errors, that this court can look at whether the jury could have convicted him of kidnapping without convicting him of that aggravated offense, finding that death resulted. And the answer is absolutely not. And that's true not only because of the facts and the testimony, but most significantly, as this court noted in a prior appeal, so in appeal 14-2256 involving Ruiz, in its order, the court noted that the jury found that death resulted from the kidnapping in the context of the RICO count. So a predicate for the RICO conspiracy was felony murder of Estrada. And so necessarily the jury found that in that context.
Does the finding have to go further, though, and find that the death resulted from a use of force?
The government doesn't believe it does. The government's position is, although that use of force is not an explicit element, that where you have a kidnapping that is willfully done, as it's required to be under the statute to have ransom or a reward, and death results from it, the causation requirement means that death is resulting from the use of force as part of the kidnapping.
Let me ask you this hypothetical. I know we're over time. Suppose the kidnappers had been driving down the Dan Ryan Expressway, observing the speed limit, you know, taking all care as they are heading off toward Indiana, and all of a sudden a drunk driver appears from nowhere, crashes into the car. The car burns up and the kidnapping victim is killed. So in my hypothetical, the kidnappers are not engaged even in reckless activity. They're just subject to one of those risks that any driver has who is out there on the interstate highways. So there's a kidnapping and death resulted, but no link and no use of force. So is that something that the statute would cover in your view?
Well, I think that there's a series of imaginative hypotheticals.
That's not imaginative, though. People die in the Dan Ryan every year. That's why I choose that example. I think it's much more realistic than the asphyxiation examples or the like. You can be driving down the road and a different driver, we've all seen them zipping around on the highways, can cause your car to get into a crash, and regrettably, people die in those crashes with some regularity. They're like little posters that Illinois puts up on the highways every year, you know, 1,000 people have died this year in the Illinois roads.
So I think that there's two questions there. One is whether that would satisfy the causation element of 1201. So Barrage, the Supreme Court in Barrage addressed that death results language from 841 and says that causation requirement means that it must have resulted from the actions, the plan of the defendant. And it imposes a but-for causation requirement as to part of it if there's an independent cause issue. And I think that there's a factual question of whether that your hypothetical meets those requirements. But even so, at the very least, that would be recklessness by placing that individual into the circumstances in which they could be harmed during the kidnapping. And of course, that raises the issues that are currently under consideration by the Supreme Court. And we don't have an answer to that at this moment. But the government's position is that the recklessness would suffice as well.
So it's, it's automatically reckless to put somebody in a car then.
No, that's not what the government is saying. However, by transport, you're inveigling, decoying, confining an individual in violation of the statute for the purpose of collecting ransom, and you then willfully transport them across state lines and death results, that's not just putting somebody in a car. That is a course of events that you've engaged in for the purposes of kidnapping somebody and then placing them into a position where they are harmed, actually to the point of death. The government's position is at the very least that would be recklessness, and that would suffice. Thank you, Your Honors, and we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Mr. Henderson, I'll give you another minute to, if you have anything further.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have one thought to share, and I think we have a fundamental agreement or disagreement about the district court's authority under Section 2255. And the court has already decided this issue. After Bailey in the 90s, we cite a number of cases in our opening brief on page 51, where the court says, if you grant relief, if a Section 924C conviction is invalid, you must grant relief under Section 2255B, and discretionary, in terms of discretionary terms, the district court has the authority to reopen the whole sentence. It doesn't have to. That mandate in Section 2255B is discretionary. And so the court can just correct the sentence as may appear appropriate. That's not necessarily resentencing.
Suppose you're right about that, Mr. Henderson, and I think your reading of the case law is correct. But isn't the, how do you respond to the point of, okay, at that resentencing, though, the statutory mandatory life sentence on two of the counts would be required to be imposed?
I disagree with that as a matter of law, because at resentencing, you have to adhere to the Constitution. And so the Constitution says that a jury must make findings to justify those mandatory life sentences. And so the court would be authorized to impose life, but it would not be mandatory. It's different than harmless error. Once a sentence has been imposed,
yeah, you'd be saying it's not a retroactive application of Apprendi and Alene, it's a present tense application, is your point.
Exactly right. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement and the court will be in recess.